Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Inform meeting with author, journalist, and human guinea pig David Ewing Duncan. David Ewing Duncan is an award-winning, best-selling author of 6 books, numerous essays, articles, and short stories, and is television, radio, and film producer and correspondent. Duncan's on a quest of chemical self-discovery. National Geographic sponsored a test for 320 chemicals he might have picked up from food, drink, the air, and ordinary products, compounds acquired by merely living. He ran the test to learn what substances build up in a typical American over a lifetime and where they might come from. What he found was disturbing. Please welcome David Ewing Duncan.
Thank you, Caroline, and thank you all for coming. I'm here to talk about something few of us think about, although I imagine some of you in the audience probably think about it more than others since you're here. Most of us take for granted the whole realm that we call chemicals. And also, I'm going to talk about what happens when one man, which is me, little old me, sets out on a chemical mystery tour of sorts of his own body. Now, I want to start out by asking some questions to you all, and I want to just get your brains going here just a bit to wrap around some of the topics I'm going to talk about. These are very simple questions, and I'll maybe get you to raise your hands. How many people here would be willing to give up, are you ready for this? Scented deodorant. Okay, nearly everyone. Oh, boy. Can you imagine this room? All right, cell phones. I wonder if you really would. Okay, it gets tougher, as you can tell here. How about automobiles? Okay, we have city people. I would say that's probably about a third of the audience. And here's one that may shock you a bit. It certainly does me, since I'm an author. What about books? Would anyone give up books? One person. Books do contain chemicals, actually quite a few of them. And I just wonder, as we walk through this journey here this evening for the next little bit, think about all of that, because those are the sort of things that chemicals give us. And I'm going to talk about what some of the consequences have been for us living in this chemical world. And I do want to thank National Geographic, who allowed me to do this story, and the photographer for the story, who is Peter Essick. And we know him well here, even if we don't realize it, for the earthquake story he did and also the story on San Francisco. He was the photographer that illustrated those stories. And for those of you listening on the radio, the audience here is going to see some of Peter's photos up on the screen. And for those of you who are not here to see them, you can check online on the National Geographic site. You can either put in my name or something about toxins or pollution or something, and you'll probably end up on the article, and you'll be able to see those photographs. Also, if you happen to have the hard copy, it was the October 2006 issue. Now, the title of this talk is My Toxic Body, and I'd like to change this ever so slightly to Toxic Man with a question mark. And this will become apparent because a lot of what I'm going to be talking about here, these trace amounts of chemicals that are actually inside of all of us, much is unknown, much more is unknown than known about these chemicals and what they do inside of us in these tiny little quantities. The subtitle is One Man's Journey to Find the Pollution Within. Sounds like one of those National Geographic television shows. And as Caroline said, I did have myself tested for 320 chemicals. And as far as I know, for a single individual, that's as many as ever been tested in a single person. And these are chemicals in the environment. And the scientific term for this is called chemical body burden study. And that takes some of the punch out of it a bit. But it's what I have on board and what all of us carry. And I'll be telling you my results, but these are actually all of our results, because the point of this story is that I'm just an average person what I've brought on board, most likely most of us have most of these chemicals on board as well. So it's a typical person's results. Now, before we talk about me, I want to go back in time for a minute and to 1935. Now, chemicals, I'm sure many of you coming here tonight view that word with great suspicion. And in fact, when you hear some of my results and some of the things that may be inside of us, that will support that contention that you would feel at least an unease about this. But that hasn't always been so. Back in 1935, DuPont came up with this slogan, better things through better living through chemistry. And this term was part of the culture at the time because for the previous 50 years or so, before 1935, chemicals had changed life dramatically for people, at least in the West. And they continued to do so through the 1980s, which is how long this slogan actually was the official slogan of DuPont. And I want to emphasize what we're talking about here, these little chemicals. And for those of you here tonight, you can see just a very simple chemical structure here. A man-made chemical, and we all know what this is, even if you don't recognize it from the diagram, it's DDT. DDT, of course, was banned in the early 70s, but I wanted to show what we're actually talking about here, at least as a schematic. And DDT, by the way, back in the 40s, was considered to be a sort of miracle substance. And this gets to the slogan, the DuPont slogan, a better life through chemistry. There was actually the fellow who invented this, or actually discovered it, was named Paul Müller. He was a Swiss chemist. And in 1948, he won the Nobel Prize for discovering DDT. And again, we think of this, if there's sort of a different kind of audience, we might be getting hisses at this point, hiss to DDT, because it was discovered much later by the 60s and Rachel Carson and Silent Spring to be a chemical that did a great deal of damage in the environment. But back in the 40s, especially during World War II, it was used widely to get rid of malaria, or the mosquitoes that caused malaria. And that's why it was considered a wonder chemical. It saved many, many lives, not only in World War II, but even through my childhood growing up in Kansas, which we'll talk about in a minute, they were still spraying DDT. It was still legal. And we were the nutty kids that went on our bikes back behind, the trucks spraying, going through the smoke. And you'll find out the repercussions of that here in a minute. Anyway, some other chemicals that are in use today or have been recently banned, say, in the last 30 or 40 years, but are very much a part of our environment. I mentioned DDT. We've got flame retardants, plasticizers, pesticides, plastics, the metals like mercury and lead, PCBs, which are flame retardants, phthalates, things that many of you may have never heard of, but are in all over the place in products and things that you're using. This is a number that astonished me. 82,000 chemicals have been approved by the Environmental Protection Agency since 1976. And give you an idea of the scope of this industry, this is the sales in 2005 of all chemical, the revenues of all chemicals in the world, all companies, all sales, $2.24 trillion. Now, I've been trying to figure out the global GDP. It's somewhere around $35, $37 trillion. So this gives you some idea of the activity that goes into creating these chemicals and how much of an impact it really is on our lives. That's an extraordinary number. I don't know of any other industry that even would come close to that. And, of course, we get great stuff, which I suggested earlier when I asked you your questions. We get plastic, we get cell phones, we get electricity, we get television, deodorant. Deodorant's a bit small. Airplanes, and one of my favorites, teddy bears. And the reason that teddy bears is on the list is because there are various chemicals that are used to make the materials in there and also flame retardants. PVC pipe, toilet paper, Teflon. We could go on and on and on and on. They're everywhere. And it turns out these chemicals are everywhere on Earth. They're in polar bears and in the Arctic. They've been discovered in lots of animals in very remote places. They're in our rivers and streams, in our trees. They're in our cities. They're in our food. They're in our children. And they're in me. And you. I want to emphasize again that these are tiny amounts, and what you've got in most cases is chemicals that are parts per billion. And just to visualize that, if you think about dropping a teaspoon of red dye into an Olympic pool, and you know how that would immediately dissipate and you wouldn't see the red, that's what we're talking about here. And in some cases, it's even parts per trillion. And so these are teeny, weeny, weeny little amounts. In fact, they're so small that science couldn't even trace most of them in the human body or in other organisms until just recently as technologies marched along. So are they dangerous? That's the big question. You know, are we carrying these things? Are they harmless? Are they dangerous? What is the deal? There have been tests run on many of these chemicals. It's a pretty scary litany of what happens when you have high doses of these chemicals. Lowers IQ, neurotoxins, cancer in many of these, hormone disruptions, birth defects, nervous system toxins, et cetera, and a pretty scary list. But most of these tests have been done in animals, and we still don't really know much about what happens in humans, except in a few very extreme cases where people have been exposed to large amounts. For those of you listening, this is one of Peter's photographs of three women in Richmond, California, just across the bay here, who have had breast cancer, and they've all been treated, and they've licked it, they've licked the cancer, but they live very near the refineries over there, the chemical plants, which are in our backyard here in San Francisco. And they're convinced, anyway, that they acquired their cancer through contact with these chemicals. We do have some disturbing statistics. Autism has doubled in the last several years. One leukemia is up 62%. Children's brain cancer is up 40%. Sperm density is down. Actually, male sterility is on the rise. But what exactly does that mean? Because none of those diseases have actually been positively linked to these chemicals, or at least the trace chemicals inside of us, these small amounts of chemicals, which of course means that you have dueling experts. And as a journalist, I always love this because you get one person saying one thing, one person saying the other. And in the absence of real data, this is what you get. So we've had... one of the people who was very helpful in my story was Leo Trasande, a physician at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. He told me that chemical exposure is an uncontrolled experiment on America's children. Obviously, he's in a camp that believes that even small amounts of these chemicals are probably dangerous. Another very respected medical toxicologist in Denver, Scott Phillips, told me, quote, "Chemicals are not all bad. While we have seen cancer rates rise, we've also seen the human lifespan double in the last century." And again, we have to keep that in mind. You know, we're all, I think anyway, most of us here are reasonably healthy. You know, I've had many, many people after writing the article write and call me and email me about ailments that they have caused by chemicals. So there certainly are a lot of people out there who've had problems. But the vast majority of people are still walking around, you know, at least as far as we know, relatively healthy. And I ran this quote by "the chemicals are not all bad," Leo Trasade from Mount Sinai, and the idea that we doubled lifespan in the last century. And he said, well, maybe we'd live even longer if we didn't have all these chemicals running around. Human tests, we talked about animal tests a minute ago. You obviously, or at least ethically, it's difficult to test the large doses you would need to find out what toxicity levels are for humans. But there are some kind of funny tests going on. Another one of Peter's photographs is a man whose head is in a box, and there are scientists around in lab coats spraying various, I don't know if you can see those, but it's deodorants and perfumes and things. So he's breathing those in, and they're going to test his blood to see how much of those chemicals that these various common household products, how much that's saturated inside of his blood. So there are some human tests happening. There also, very recently, in 2005, was the first time ever a major study on average levels of many of the major chemicals in the U.S. And this was done by the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, the CDC. And this was a huge breakthrough because One of the problems with human toxicity in these small levels has been you didn't even know what averages are in America. And that's a baseline which needed to be established. And this report, which is online on the CDC site, it's actually quite interesting. It talks about averages. It talks about the highest percentiles of people who, say, have occupational exposures, things like that, for 148 chemicals. And if you're really interested in this and want to nerd out a little bit, go hang out on the site and check that out. Now, we've been talking about small amounts, but of course there have been accidents over time, various other means for testing more profound exposures. And by the way, I should have prefaced earlier in the talk that we are talking about humans tonight. There are all sorts of other issues and very interesting topics and scary and interesting things about the environment, of course. But this is focused primarily on one organism, which is us. So we've got a little catalog of some of Peter's photographs here of some cases of extreme exposure. This is a little girl in Cleveland who was exposed to lead, probably lead paint in an old house. This is the photograph that was the most controversial and talked about in the article. It's a little girl in Vietnam whose mother was exposed to Agent Orange during the Vietnam War, and she was born without eyes. And it's a particular syndrome that was probably caused by the dioxin. Also, in the developing world, we have enough problems here with pesticides, but in the developing world where a lot of our food is grown, pesticides are used by workers there with very little protection. And especially, at least I looked into Central America, they're used in other places too. There have been higher than usual instances of leukemia and sterility. So you get an example here of what happens to humans when you have exposure to certain pesticides. Here's an image of an X-ray being looked at by a physician of a child who has ingested lead. And I don't know if you can see those little specks in there, but this child actually survived and did okay because they were able to flush it out before it did too much damage. So where do they come from? Where do these chemicals come from? We've talked about some of the items that we use, but obviously they come from lots of different places. I want to talk about, again, Peter's fabulous photography here, and this is Bangkok. And what you've got here is a huge chemical plant in the background with some of the wealthiest homes in Bangkok right in front of it. It's an upper-class neighborhood. Just hard on this huge expanse of chemical factories. They come from cell phones, as we talked about. They come from common household products. I think this is actually a friend of Peter's who he just went down in the basement and took a photograph. It's very interesting for a National Geographic photographer who's used to going out on all these exotic assignments, trying to capture the snow leopard or something. And now here he's getting photographs in his friend's house in the basement. We get it from things we do every week, putting gas in our vehicles, painting in our living rooms. Our living rooms have flame retardants, lots of other chemicals in them, plastics. And, of course, one of the chemicals I was tested for are some of the breakdowns of cigarettes, and that's one we can control by not smoking. In the article and on the website, we created, or the wonderful graphic artists at National Geographic created the toxic home. And I encourage you all to go on the site. It's interactive. It's sort of interesting to play around with. This is the static version, but this tells you where in your house and in your environment or in a typical environment you might find some of these chemicals. And again, I want to keep emphasizing not to terrify anybody here because these are tiny, tiny, tiny amounts. And frankly, there's not a lot you can do about most of it, or at least the exposure. Some of them you can get rid of through various means, but you're going to probably get them back again. And they are tiny, small amounts. Bedroom, the living room. And then, of course, there's my life with chemicals and what I get in my house. And they asked me to look very stern in that photograph, by the way. Cooking, here's me cooking breakfast, and I've got the Teflon pan, the plastic coffee cup, the flame retardant clothes, just dinner with my family. We've got chemicals of varying sorts. buying food in the store. I, you know, like a lot of people in California, try to buy organic. I'm not even really sure what that means sometimes. I guess it mostly means that it's not grown with pesticides, but there's still a lot of chemicals that will get into our food no matter what we do. These are really exciting pictures, I know, but it does illustrate you know, just the mundaneness of this, really, of our daily lives. In my office with my younger son, with my, you know, plasticizers on my computer and various other chemicals. My journey began for this story with having 14 vials of blood drawn. I don't know if you've ever had that much blood drawn. It felt like it was about 3/4 of my blood. And it was quite dramatic. I nearly passed out, and they had to use smelling salts. And Dr. Tassande was there. Do you really want to do this? I was like, yes, for science, for journalism. And so we shipped the blood up. There are only a few labs in the entire world that actually can do this very fine-tuned testing of these minute chemicals. And if you think about a drop of blood, all the chemicals that are in there that are supposed to be there, you know, these are the chemicals in your body, much less these tiny little ones that you know, we would hope would not be there. And there are a couple of photographs here of the lab up in Canada. It's on Vancouver Island, and they specialize mostly in testing the environment, but they also do some human testing. There's also a wonderful lab at the CDC in Atlanta, but they don't allow individuals to be tested there. Those are larger tests. So they use these filtering mechanisms. They try to wean out these chemicals. And as I said earlier, this is pretty recent technology to be able to even find these chemicals, and some of them are undetectable. I ended up having 165 chemicals of the 320 tested, and that was just those that were detectable. I may have all of them, for all we know, but they were just not detectable. After they run through all those various filters and they finally get out their little parts per billion, then they run it through these fancy machines called mass spectrometers, which look sort of like a white coffin here. And these actually throw the atoms of the particular chemicals down a vacuum, and they're measured that way by their atomic weight, how fast they hit a filter at the other end. And it costs about $1 million a piece, which makes these tests sort of difficult to do. I'm not the only one that's been tested, and I'm not sure why we don't see Bill Moyers here, but Bill Moyers was tested on PBS, you know, on his program on PBS, for 214 chemicals, and he had 87 detected. And there have been a lot of us individuals and small groups that have been tested. You know, partly, actually, I just got a press release the other day that 4 members of the parliament in Canada were just tested for several chemicals up there. And it's all kind of saying the same thing. And we can compare it now to this study I talked about earlier with the CDC. I'm not sure why these aren't coming out, but there was a cord blood study done by the Environmental Working Group in Washington, and they also have a chapter here in Oakland, and they're doing some great work on kind of pioneering these high-profile studies. They had 10 babies tested for 413 chemicals, with 287 chemicals detected. And this is babies. These are people just born. And what that means is they have chemicals in them from the moment they're, well, pretty much have a bloodstream or somewhere for them to get into, passed on by their mothers. So I get my report card. We go through that whole blood drawing, you know, lab work, all of that. I'm sitting there waiting anxiously, and finally it arrives. And this is a compendium of the report card, and the details are on my website, which I'll give you later, and also on the National Geographic site. But as I said, 320 chemicals tested, 165 detected, and the whole cost was $15,000. And I even got a discount. It would normally be about probably close to twice that. The lab in question gave us a discount, but it's very expensive for them to run these tests, so they did charge us for some. So before you race out to get these, you know, there is a bit of a price tag, even if you can find a lab that will do it. Although some of the tests are cheap and easily available, like, say, mercury or lead, those are about $30 or $40 a piece, and you can go out and get them in any lab. What's inside me? Again, 320 tested, 165 detected. 155 of these were higher than the mean. not by much in most cases. But I will go over just some samples here of some of the chemicals. I won't go through all of them to give you an idea of what was inside of me. Pesticides. Part of what, by the way, I did for National Geographic was, in typical geographic form, I did go on a trek or a journey. And I actually, they sent me back to where I grew up and some of the highlights of my life where I happened to be, trying to figure out where I may have been exposed to some of these chemicals. And as I went back to my childhood in Kansas, you know, I was remembering riding my bike through clouds of DDT, things like that. So not surprisingly, I have a very high level of DDE, which is a metabolite that DDT breaks down into. And, you know, it's close to off the chart there. And it's fairly typical of people my age who were around in the Midwest when they were spraying DDT. Now, this is actually, according to the toxicologist I talked to, has gone down substantially since I was a kid. Each of these chemicals has a certain amount of time they last inside your body, and DDT is about 20 to 30 years. Some of them, like some of the plasticizers, last only a few hours, but you know, you're constantly re-exposed. Or mercury lasts about 30 to 60 days. So my childhood in Kansas, I grew up in a place called Lake Quivira, which is right outside of Kansas City, and I had a rather surprising thing happen. For a journalist, it was great. For me as an individual, not so great. It turns out I grew up on this lake, and it was a wooded, nice place to grow up as a kid. The Kansas River was within a mile or so of the lake. We as boys used to roam the woods, and there was a big dump there, and we used to play in the dump. Well, it turns out, years later, when I went back to check this out, this is a major Superfund site filled with all kinds of nasty chemicals, and they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars cleaning this thing up. And there's a list online where I could go and see what the chemicals were and then compare that to my results, and sure enough, some of them showed up in there. So that was a coincidence, but it shows you, you know, where you can be exposed. As I said, I grew up when pesticides were still great. Everybody loved them, especially out in my part of the world. You know, we saw scenes like biplanes spraying pesticides all the time. I was right on the edge of the city, and on one side was, you know, the suburbs, and on the other side were farmland. So we roamed around a lot and saw scenes like biplanes throwing out pesticides and all sorts of other means of applying them pretty much every day. Kansas City, when I was a kid, not far from where I lived, looked like a kind of polluted nightmare. It was an area, heavy industry. There were some auto plants, chemical plants. And I remember driving through this soup. One way to get into the city was to drive through just this soup of chemicals. And we would roll up our windows and hold our breath like that was going to help. And this is the actual report online, if you go and look at it, where it says the groundwater, soil, and leachate are contaminated with volatile organic chemicals, pesticides, polychlorinated biphenyls, which are PCBs, et cetera, et cetera. And this goes on and on and on, page after page after page, in the place where I played as a child. PCBs. This was another fantastic chemical to people up until the time that we discovered, a scientist discovered, that it was polluting rivers and lakes, and it was getting inside of fish and inside of humans. I went to school at Vassar College on the Hudson River in Poughkeepsie, and the plant, one of the major plants in the world that produced PCBs, was a General Electric plant up in Hudson Falls and Fort Edward. It was two plants very near each other. And for the better part of about 30 or 40 years, they produced huge quantities of PCBs. And basically, some of it anyway, leached into the Hudson. And it's all, you know, it's all over the place still, and there's a huge battle going on up there as they're trying to clean it up. It may be the largest Superfund site. I have to check that. It's certainly one of them. It's 200 miles of the Hudson River they're talking about dredging and cleaning up, because these PCBs are heavy. They sink to the bottom. Fish eat them, and if we humans eat the fish, we get them inside of us. And Poughkeepsie, by the way, is one of the few towns in the whole Hudson River Valley that actually draws its drinking water directly from the Hudson. And I tried to investigate, this was back in the late 70s when I went to college there, did they do tests at the time for PCBs? Did they discover any? And it was I never did really find the answer to that. They said that they tested it, and there were actually standards on the books, but there were no records of them having done it. So this is the General Electric plant up in Hudson Falls. It's closed now. It's been closed for many years. On the lower right-hand corner, there is a close-up of that beach, and you can actually see little pellets if you look really closely, and those are PCBs. The worst PCBs have traits of dioxin, which of course is a known carcinogen, and I haven't really checked why I have such a high level of PCB 66 or what exactly that is, but I had fairly typical results for PCBs, even though I may have been exposed to them when I was in college. These stick with you, by the way. These guys hang around for several centuries. So their half-life, and wherever they are, is several centuries. Another class is phthalates, and I had to kind of learn how to pronounce that. P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S, phthalates. And most of us have no idea what phthalates are, and yet they're everywhere. They're in plastic kids' toys. They're in the plastic wrap we put on food. They until recently were in IV tubes, although they're not in there anymore, apparently. I have higher than normal levels. Another thing that phthalates is used for, it's a very interesting chemical. It's used as a plasticizer. It's also used to help facilitate putting scents, things like mint or lavender, into shampoos and the deodorant we talked about earlier. And that's where most of us are exposed to it. The plastics, there's some debate of how much it actually breaks off or is removed from the plastics. I was told by some of the experts it's probably not a great idea to microwave plastic containers. And some of them say, that they're microwave safe, and that should mean that they don't have phthalates or other plasticizers. But what the heck? Why not just microwave in some other substance? There aren't many, by the way, chemicals where I can say, or an expert or anyone can say, here's what you can do about it. But that is one thing you can do. I came out with higher than average phthalates, or these two phthalates anyway. They're by the way, many different types of these chemicals are very closely related in the same chemical families. And I was not nearly as high as the highest levels that were tested in the CDC study, but higher than average. And when I asked Dr. Trasande about that, he said it was because I had my blood drawn in the morning right after I took a shower, and I probably had used something that smelled really great when I was washing my hair. And that would have dissipated by, say, the middle of the day or the afternoon, only to come back again when I shampooed my hair next. The final group of chemicals that I'll talk about tonight, and there's several more, and you can look up the rest of them if you want to on the website, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, PBDEs. These are flame retardants. And they were introduced mostly by law and regulation to great public acclaim 30 or 40 years ago to protect us from being burned up. Now, I sent all of my results to various experts around the world and got back reports. One of the great experts of PBDEs in the world is Aki Bergman from Stockholm University in Sweden. And I was sitting in an airport, and I was scheduled to call him, so I called him up. And he said, "I hope you were not nervous, but this concentration is very high." Can't do a Swedish accent, sorry. It sounded very guttural to me, though. I don't know, maybe because of what he was saying. Anyway, "I hope you're not nervous, but this concentration is very high." And I was like, okay. I already knew that comparing it to some studies, but to hear the experts say. These are a couple things that happen when you get high levels of PBDEs in animals, thyroid disruption, neurodevelopmental disorders, and I have question marks after that because this is not a hugely well-understood chemical. It's fairly recent. It's been building up in the environment. Some of the tests have been done on animals, but it's not as extensive as some of the other chemicals. Okay, now, PBDE-47, which is called Penta-PBDE, and that's because of its chemical structure. I was extraordinarily high in this. For those of you who can't see this chart, it's a gigantic green column right next to a tiny little red column, and the green is my results, and the red is the average. And I had 10 times the average of the average American, and I had 200 times the average in Europe. And that's because Europeans don't use the Pentas as much as some other PBDEs. This was rather shocking, and the CDC, by the way, has not studied PBDEs, so these were some small studies. They're not as comprehensive as the CDC studies. But this was a little alarming. 10 times the average, as I said, in the U.S., 200 times in Sweden and in the EU. Now, of course, this means if you light me on fire, I will not burn. Where did they come from? Where did they come from? No, they did not come from my dog. There's a picture of my dog up here. But the couch that my dog is standing on was a likely culprit. Oftentimes, these particular flame retardants spike in people because you bought a new piece of furniture or a mattress, a new computer, or any kind of electrical appliance. You know, they're loaded with these PBDEs, and they, in the early stages after you bought them, when they heat up these appliances, you get a little gas of this stuff coming off, and so your levels might spike. But I didn't have any of that. I didn't have any new stuff, just same old, same old. And so Aki Bergman and I were sitting there talking in the airport saying, well, you know, where do they come from? And then I got an idea, because I've been reading up on this. Maybe they come from airplanes. I do a lot of flying, not nearly as much as some people, but I fly a couple hundred thousand miles a year, and planes are drenched in these things everywhere. Seats, the trays, the electrical wiring, and behind the panels, and you're sitting there for sometimes hours on end with these chemicals floating around. And not long ago, they discovered the entry point. All of these chemicals have an entry point. It's breathing in, it's eating them, it's drinking them, it's through your skin. This particular one is dust. So these chemicals attach to dust. People bring dust on the plane. These little guys break off from wherever they are, and they attach to the dust, and you breathe them in. Now, note that I said when I got this news, I was sitting in an airport, San Francisco International, actually, and I was about to board a plane. So this was not good news. Now, we don't know that that's for sure. That was just total speculation. Although it did trigger Dr. Bergman, has been for a while wanting to run some tests on pilots and flight attendants to see, in fact, if they have higher than the normal levels of PBDEs. Now, I've mentioned here throughout the talk that we have this somewhat devil's bargain with chemicals. And this is a very good example of that. We have these flame retardants for a reason. This isn't something that we demanded to have in products in terms of, like having a better cell phone or something. It's not something the chemical industry just decided to put in, that we never knew about. These are things that are required by law. And the specifications for airplanes, which I looked up, are extensive. So these save a lot of lives. They save hundreds of lives a year, and they prevent thousands of people from having serious burns. There is no evidence right now that these tiny quantities, and even though that my chart was huge on that, it's still a tiny amount. There's no evidence that that causes harm for humans. So, we need to constantly be thinking of this balance, this sort of double-edged sword of these chemicals, and whether we can live with them or not. By the way, I'm nearly finished here in about 5 minutes, and if people have questions, think about moving up towards the microphone, and we'll start those in a few minutes here. Oops, I do have one more chemical I'm going to talk about, mercury. This is not the kind of mercury you get in a thermometer. It's not the silver stuff. This is actually called methylmercury. It's a form of mercury that happens when mercury comes in contact with organisms in the environment that turn it into a substance that is much more prevalent than the heavy metal, like in a thermometer. And so what you do, or most methyl mercury comes from coal-burning power plants, and we've been reading a lot about them recently in China. And in fact, I've seen satellite images of clouds of smoke coming across from, you can actually see from space, coming across from China, and they get caught up in the upper atmosphere, and they basically sprinkle methyl mercury out over the Pacific Ocean. And it's, coal is obviously burned for electricity, it's released into the air, it settles over the ocean, it's absorbed by the plankton, the little fish eat the plankton, bigger fish eat the little fish, huge fish eat the big fish, and then we humans eat fish of varying sizes. But the mercury, the methyl mercury, accumulates mostly in these huge fish. And that would be a tuna fish sandwich if you could see it. But I used to love a tuna fish sandwich a couple times a month. But tunas are large fish, and methyl mercury accumulates in these large fish much more than in smaller fish. And this is home sweet home here, this is San Francisco Bay. And, you know, again, you can see these clouds of these effluents coming over. And I don't mean to pick on the Chinese, although they've been building a lot of plants recently. They also, we get this from our own plants and from lots of other places around the Pacific Rim. Here's the tuna I was just talking about. That would be another tuna meal right there. My test for this, I did the methyl mercury panel just with all the other tests, and I got a pretty normal reading of 5 parts per million. The danger level is considered to be around 10 parts per million. You don't want to go over that threshold. So I don't eat a lot of fish, except for the tuna fish every so often. So this is probably fairly typical of somebody that doesn't eat a lot of fish. But I did decide to run a little experiment. I went out and I bought down at the farmer's market in San Francisco, at the Ferry Building, a big steak of tuna and a halibut. And I ate those. And I don't know why we're not getting these in here, but I ate those for dinner and for breakfast. I had my blood tested that afternoon, and I spiked up to 12 parts per million. So I more than double my load of mercury. And mercury does last in your body about 30 to 60 days. So that put me up over the safety threshold to 12 parts per million. And I'm, by the way, going to be working on a new book, which I'm going to get into more of this stuff and run some more experiments like that. I don't know, I'm kind of a nut, don't you think? Okay, the good news in this is that we as humans have banded together in the past, and we've done something about some of these chemicals. So we passed the Clean Air Act in the 70s when most of these happened, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Toxic Substances Act. And we have managed to, you know, go from my childhood memories of vast pollution to cleaning up some of this environment. This is an image of not far from where I grew up and not far from where that scene you just saw of all the pollution was taken. It's a pristine Kansas River, not far from where I grew up. So we have been able to solve these problems, so we should take some heart in that. DDT was banned in 1972, PCBs in 1977. The PBDEs, the flame retardants I talked about, have been banned in Europe already. California will have them fully banned by 2008. And in fact, the Penta PBDE that I had such a high level of has already been voluntarily phased out by the company. Now, there are other flame retardants out there, which I've not been tested for. But one of the ways out of this and asking the question, can we do better? Well, can we do better? We can ask that. I looked around just to see what the public thinks about this, and in a Harris poll that asked, do you agree or disagree with the following statement? Protecting the environment is so important that requirements and standards cannot be too high, and continuing environmental improvements must be made regardless of the cost. That was a quote. And 74% of Americans who were polled agree with that. And I'm not a huge one on polls, but I think that's pretty clear the way people want to go with this. We have 1,700 new chemicals every year, 90% of which come out released officially, approved by the EPA, with no restrictions. But we still love these chemicals. all the things we get from them, cell phones, electricity, automobiles. There are some solutions coming up, which are quite interesting, which will be the subject, hopefully, of future articles by me and others, and it's already been being written about, the green chemistry movement, clean tech, and hopefully enlightened self-interest by some companies, realizing that we do need to do something about this as the levels of some of these chemicals continue to increase. In Marin County, one of Peter's photographs here, these young women are using cosmetics that are chemical, or at least have bad chemicals taken out of them, carcinogens and others. And, you know, they look fine to me, so maybe we need to switch. Am I worried? Yes. These chemicals are not only in me, they're in my children. And no. I'm still using most of the stuff. I mean, I'm still living in the same environment, driving my car, using my cell phone. The main thing is here, we need to know more. And that's really the message I want to leave you all with. We don't know how harmful these small amounts of chemicals are. They might be slowly doing damage to us. They may not. We need to know more. And that's really the message, the central message here. And if you need more information, you can check out my website and the National Geographic website. The CDC has a great site, National Institutes of Health, Environmental Working Group, and some others. I also want to thank, again, the folks at National Geographic, Peter Resick, the photographer, and others, and special thanks to my family who put up with photographers and people running around in the house. And that's the website. It's basically myname.com, and you can find out some more information on that. So I really appreciate it, and thank you all for listening.
We're going to be heading to the Q&A portion of tonight's program. So go ahead and start lining up at the mic in the aisle, and we're talking with David Ewing Duncan. So thank you again.
Hey, well, don't be shy here, people. Yes?
Tyrone Hayes, who's a UC Berkeley biologist, studied atrazine's effects on frogs and found that it's turning male frogs into female frogs. Mm. Do you know anything about that study?
No, I've heard about it, but I don't know that much about it. I think it had to do with temperature, though, didn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
And the other thing was Marla Cohn's book, Silent Snow.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that book?
I know of it, but
yeah. The interesting thing is the high amounts of concentrations occurring at the North Pole are actually changing polar bears. Male polar bears are becoming female.
Oh, so interesting. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, and what they're saying is the birth defects and the effects on young children, Eskimo children up there, are really dramatic, and they're finding when they test them for chemicals, the loads are really high. So as you pointed out, they're coming up and going down and ending up in the North Pole more concentrated than even next to a chemical plant in New Jersey. So it seems like the concentrations keep building. And they build, obviously, around fat, so they build in seals and whales, and the Eskimos pick that up in high quantities. So I was just wondering if you saw anything about that.
Well, there are a lot of studies, which are pretty alarming about where these chemicals are showing up, and they're showing up everywhere. You know, they're mm-hmm. showing up in the ice packs and animals, you know, on both poles, some of the remotest places in, like, the Himalayas and, mm-hmm. and all over the planet. And some of them, especially some of the more recent ones, like the flame retardants, are rising pretty rapidly. Some of the others, the so-called legacy chemicals like DDT and PCBs are well, not so much PCBs because they stick around so long, but some of the pesticides are in decline because they haven't been used for a while. But, you know, that even gets into their debates about whether it should be brought back in some cases for malaria in Africa. So, yeah, I mean, these things are, you know, they're everywhere. They're in us. They're in animals. And this, every study that's done seems to bear that out.
And do you know of any studies that are being done to see what the long-term effects on people are?
I did do a fair amount of digging on that. And as I said, there, other than these severe exposures, and there have been a number of them, especially some dioxin spills in Italy and mercury spills in Japan in the 50s, they have tracked those people, but those are what you need is more in between data. You know, you have these extreme exposures, and some people died. Others had very, very serious consequences, and then you have us that have mm-hmm. the smaller quantities. And toxicologists, when they're running tests on other organisms, build up levels to see what the threshold is. You can't really, you wouldn't do that. And in fact, The EPA tried to do that not too long ago to intentionally expose some humans to small amounts of pesticides, and there was an outcry, and they withdrew that test. But have any other?
What about wine?
Would you mind walking up to them? Okay, the question was, what about wine?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'm actually working on a story on resveratrol, the chemical in wine that extends lifespan. So that part of wine is great. Go out and drink a lot, especially red wine. Well, it depends on the wine. I don't know specifically about it. We'd have to ask somebody who's an expert. But there certainly are different chemicals, especially preservatives and others, I don't know much about. But, you know, I think wine is considered to be generally healthy. But maybe we should look into it, right? Yeah.
Well, I can give you a little bit of information about the in-between exposure. I was one of the people who worked in the UCSF building in the early 90s. Auto body paint chemicals were coming into the building from Aliotto's auto body shop next door. So after a period of working in the building for about 7 years, ingesting through my skin and my breathing and so on, low levels of auto body paint chemicals, many people in the building not only became chemically sensitive, but we lost our ability to read. We were no longer articulate. Definitely there are people out there who have all kinds of information to offer.
Oh, yeah. In fact, if you go on my website and blog, I've put up some of the – I've gotten literally hundreds of people writing, calling, emailing. You know, I've been on all these radio shows and people calling in. And it clearly, someone does in the expert field need to go out and kind of collect some of that information. As I said earlier, the vast majority of us, I think, feel pretty healthy, and we haven't had the experience that you've had, fortunately. But there have been a lot of people, and it would be interesting to have some kind of systematic way to study all of that.
Well, the effects were disputed for so long. The effects of low-level, long-term exposure were disputed for so long that I think really it's only now that it's starting to get rolling. But there's definitely information out there, even if it's only anecdotal.
So. Yeah, no, there definitely is. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Haven't they discovered that these chemicals are having hormonal effects at far greater or far lesser concentrations, for example, not parts per billion, but 1,000 times less parts per trillion?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I mentioned parts per trillion early on. And it depends completely on, I mean, they say the dose makes the poison. That was said 400 or 500 years ago. It's still the case. I mean, you know, if you eat a candy bar with plutonium in it, you know, you and most of the people in the small town you're in are going to be dead. Even the tiniest little scrap that's a highly toxic and deadly. Others you can take, you know, large quantities and you're not going to get hurt. So yeah, it does depend on parts per trillion. You know, you can even probably get. It's almost impossible to measure anything below that in a human. But yeah, no, and also the length of time you're exposed as well is a big factor. And that's why some of these chemicals, like say mercury, they're only on board for 30 days or so. You know, your body flushes them out naturally, but we're constantly exposed to a background level. And some of the interesting studies being done are what happens when you kind of spike up and down, you know, people who, say, eat fish every week, you know, or big fish. And by the way, I don't want to scare people off from eating fish, but I would be a little careful on eating big fish. But I'm not an expert, but that's what the experts told me.
It seems reasonable to me that if these things are in large doses are killing people, small doses are having lesser effects, but effects.
But it does depend on the dose, and that's very important for some of these. Because you notice mercury is parts per million, so that's a much larger dose than, say, these chemicals that I'm talking about, parts per billion. But you have to be in the parts per million before at least the current research suggests that that's dangerous, or at least, you know, 10 parts per million.
And anyway. I don't believe you told us the name of your book, did you?
Oh, the book is actually not. Oh, the new book or no? No, the old book, which is out there, is my book on geneticists. It's called Masterminds: Genius DNA and the Quest to Rewrite Life. And the new book is, at least the tentative title, is called Experimental Man. Molecular autobiography. But I'm not only doing these tests, I'm getting genetic tests and neural tests, and I don't know, I'm going to be tested.
I'm curious if you explored in your research, in your current book or in your future book, the development of nanotechnology?
As a reporter, I cover life sciences, and I just recently have began to cover nanotechnology, and that's another area that's potentially toxic as well, especially in clothes and things like a lot of suntan lotions, and they use materials derived from nanotechnology. And nobody really knows what exactly these little nanoparticles are doing, because at the nano level, many substances behave in sort of odd ways from a physics standpoint. And that's one of the things that makes them attractive as a substance or a material to use for building little things. But nobody quite knows what these mean. And, you know, we're just now testing PCBs and things that have been around for decades. You know, we seem to be a long way away from understanding something like nanoparticles. But yeah, no, I think that's a fascinating area.
I just have two quick questions. One's like pretty easy, and one's like not so easy, I guess. first one, oh yeah, thank you for spending all the time, money, and energy on these experiments. First one is, what if you had to guess, what percentage of the chemical contamination or like the chemical pit in your body is from the petroleum industry? And paint or buildings. You know, if you had to guess, what percentage can you directly relate? Specifically the petroleum industry.
I don't really know. I mean, there are an awful lot of petroleum products. I mean, pretty much all plastic.
Sure. Right.
I mean, this room is filled with, you know, rugs, things. I don't know. It'd be interesting. You could probably break that down, at least in terms of dollars, from that
right.
2.24 trillion number.
That's right. That's another way to
phrase
it.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's probably available out there somewhere.
Yeah, if you had to guess, though, let's say you had to, like, bet some money on, like, what it would be, you know?
1.66 No, I really don't know.
Like half? Yeah.
Okay,
it's hard to say.
Yeah,
it's a tough question. Yeah.
I mean, it is a huge number of things, and a lot of things we don't even think about.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, our iPods.
Plastic, everything. Yeah.
The casing on the cell phones.
Skis, I mean, have plastic, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's in many, many things, and that's why when we talk about, you know, our oil dependency, we might want to think about all of that, too.
Right.
Yeah.
So this one.
Was that the easy question?
That was
question?
The hard one.
Okay.
Yeah. So the easy one is, are you planning on making like a Super Size Me type movie where you like try like 5 cans of tuna and then like DDT
it's
truck?
It's in the works.
Yeah, all right. I didn't want to spoil the surprise. Sorry.
No, I've got a couple different groups. I used to do a lot of television. I still do Nova. But we're definitely thinking about it.
Good luck with that, man. Yeah.
Thanks. That was an easy question.
Yeah, right.
Thank you.
Hello. Other than moving, I'm wondering what you would suggest about living in around a lot of pressure-treated wood and wood preservatives that have been used in the construction.
I got to say, I don't know that much about that specifically. You know, people ask me about different environments that they live in, and I'm even curious about my own. I mean, I live in a, you know, wood house with pressure-treated wood around the outside. I think the answer in general is anywhere on the planet we're exposed to these chemicals, and you certainly don't want to get an overexposure, you know, of certain chemicals. Like if you live, you're probably more dangerous living in a plant, you know, near a plant, like those women in Richmond. But I don't really know the specific answer to that. You know, if you start, I will say though, if you start thinking too hard about this, okay, well, you know, I better not use a cell phone because that's plastic. You know, oops, you know, I better not use. You know, I better not live in this room because it's got rugs. And, you know, I mean, you're going to drive yourself nuts. And I think at this point, you know, I'm concerned about some of the things I have in my environment. I'd like to know more, but I'm not panicking or saying, you know, gosh, you know, time to get in a rocket ship and go to another planet, although that would be fun for other reasons. So I think we as consumers and as citizens need to push hard to have the powers that be do their job and figure out what's going on with these chemicals and do more reports like the CDC. And, you know, hopefully we'll get a little wind change in Washington to look a little harder into some of these things. But to me, this is another inconvenient truth.
They've already done something about it in the parks where kids play. They've taken those structures down. But I live in a house, most of us do, where pressure-treated wood was used extensively, and
that's right.
Copper green, I've even gone to, well, it's wintertime, I keep my window closed so it's not coming in, but when I open the windows in the summer, my decks are filled with that stuff, and I wonder about that. And
I have no idea what the, I mean, we could probably look around and see if there's studies on that. There are all kinds of specific studies. What's that?
You shouldn't use that stuff. That stuff for really bad things.
Pressure-treated wood?
Yes.
Okay.
What was that?
Okay. Yeah, somebody just said you shouldn't use pressure-treated wood and it's bad stuff, but yeah.
Turned out my house. I wondered if maybe painting it would be suggested. Would that...
Well, then you get into the chemicals in the paint. I mean, just applying the paint. That's what I'm saying. It's kind of like chasing a dog's tail at a certain level. We have a couple more questions here about a minute or two left. Sorry we're going over here. But we'll go another minute or two.
Good evening. Thank you, David, so much for this talk tonight. This was really informative.
Thank you.
And my name is Andrea Frank-Henkart, and I'm the author of 7 books on health and wellness for the family specifically. And I've done the research, as you have. I didn't have the blood test, though, so I have a lot of respect for you for doing that. But on all the chemicals that are affecting families, and there's a piece that I'm wondering if you've looked at, which is the component of what we're actually ingesting. Because I'm sure the audience is sitting here saying, okay, well, I don't really have a lot of control over all those big chemical plants that are sending all those chemicals out, but what we do have is the control over what we're actually putting in our bodies, and especially for our children. And my books have all been on Oprah and different things like that. My books have all talk about that it's our duty for the children to make sure what they're putting in our bodies, and I personally have found a system that helps to cleanse the body and replenish. And so I'm wondering, are you focused at all on that? We have, you know, medical doctors say it's not a question of if we're going to get sick, it's when. We have 18 million kids in our country who are obese, 10% of children between the ages of 2 and 5 who are obese and who are developing type 2 diabetes, which is known as adult onset.
Yeah. I actually write a lot about that. That's sort of, you know, somewhat separate from the chemical issue. In fact, the Nova show in October, which is on my site, was on obesity and the genetics of obesity. But, I think there are certain things you can do, and it's something in my reporting and in this book I'm going to write, I'm going to get into, you know, look into a lot more. I've also been inundated with all kinds of cures, and, you know, I don't even know what to make of a lot of these. I mean, some of them seem to be really interesting and you know, maybe work. Others, I can't really tell. So that tells me something quite curious, which is that people are, with the medical community is not really responding to this in a way that maybe some of us would like. So there are, you know, many people that are going out and trying to find their own solutions. I mean, this happens. I, you know, was originally or long ago a medical reporter, and that's what happens when organized medicine doesn't address a problem that the public wants addressed. People start looking for solutions. And it's not, I think the medical establishment is beginning to look into this a lot more. And they're starting to have the tools like a CDC report and this fine testing to be able to know. But I mentioned the mercury. That's something, you know, you can do by eating less fish, plastic in microwaves. You don't want to, if you paint, you know, wear the proper protection, things like that.
Well, it's even Splenda and aspartame. Aspartame was originally made as a rat and ant poison.
Yeah.
So really what I wanted to ask you also is that I'd love to have a meeting of the minds with you on this subject, and so I'm wondering if that's something we could talk about
later. Sure, I'll be here for a few minutes.
My studies, I've worked with over 5,000 families and have helped them find a way to get rid of some of the chemicals in their bodies.
You know what, I'm sorry, time is up here and everybody's leaving. Would you guys like to meet me at the table up front and we can talk a little bit? So thank you all very much for coming.
For the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inform. Tonight we're talking with David Ewing Duncan. If you would like to see this broadcast in its entirety in video online, you can go to fora.tv. So thank you very much. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.